Welcome back, everyone, to Echo by Pam Munoz Ryan. I'm reading to you from Chicago. Today is May 23rd, and there's a huge thunderstorm outside, so you may hear a little thunder and lightning behind me. April 1951, New York City, New York, USA. This is part four. Chapter one. On an evening embroidered with the thread of destiny, in a theater crowned with a halo of light, Friedrich Schmidt escorted Father and Uncle Gunther to the best in the house seats. Friedrich's eyes swept to the tiered boxes, dress circle, and upper balconies, their facades intricately carved with laurels and painted gold. He'd been told the concert was sold out, but he still couldn't imagine every seat filled with concertgoers. You too don't mind waiting? In awe, Father waved his arm in an arc. We will sit here and admire all this majesty. We wanted to be early, said Uncle Gunther, to see the evening unfold, beginning to end. It is quite an honor to be seated by the conductor himself. It is a long road you have traveled, Friedrich. We have traveled, Uncle, together. After all, you taught me to ride a bicycle and play the harmonica. Uncle Gunther laughed and winked. I did. You're a sweet boy to remember. And who was my first and most accomplished teacher? He squeezed Father's shoulder. Father smiled at him. Thank you, son. Uncle Gunther tugged at his collar, where the silk tie he wore was knotted. His suit was a far cry from their factory overalls. You know, I only wear a tie for a few occasions, but your concerts are always worth the trouble. In recent years, Father and Uncle Gunther had attended many concerts where he had conducted, but tonight was a pinnacle debut. Friedrich perched on the arm of Father's seat, as impressed as they were with this moment and the miraculous journey that had taken them from Trossingen to Bern and ultimately here to Carnegie Hall in New York City to conduct the Empire Philharmonic. Tchaikovsky had conducted his own compositions on the hall's first opening night. The Tchaikovsky. Friedrich could hardly believe he would stand on the same stage. As if feeling his thoughts, Father said, They say that all the musicians who have performed here have left a wisp of their spirits behind. Friedrich nodded. People talked about the undeniable energy in the building. How could he harness it? Do you think Tchaikovsky was as nervous as I am? Father shook a finger at him. Of course, and I would say the same thing to him. You have as much right to be on that stage as the next conductor. Just put one foot in front of the other and look up. Friedrich patted Father's shoulder and smiled. I'll remember. On stage, the musicians' chairs sat empty in several large semicircles, waiting. A concert grand piano guarded the left of the stage. Father put a hand on Friedrich's. It is difficult to believe we are here. It seems like yesterday we were in Trossingen. I only wish... I know, Father, whispered Friedrich. I miss her too. Friedrich knew Father still held out hope that he would one day see Elizabeth again. He'd never stopped writing to her so she wouldn't forget the sound of his voice. Not during the war, when she had remained a devoted nurse, even caring for soldiers in a prisoner of war camp. Or in the years following, when she worked in a pediatric hospital in eastern Berlin. Friedrich wrote, too, especially when the opportunity to move to America was arranged. He had begged her to join him and Father and Uncle Gunther for a chance at a new life in a new country. She refused, saying she'd found her true calling. Still, Friedrich couldn't help but continue to hope that he, like his brave imaginary friend Hansel, could one day lead his sister home to their father, and that someday they'd all be together once more. Friedrich often wondered what might have happened to them if Elizabeth hadn't sent the Reichsmarks for Father's ransom. Father was right. It didn't feel like 18 years had passed since that fateful day on the train leading to Dachau. The engine had already started to chuff. Friedrich had heard the music to Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty waltz and pretended to conduct, infuriating the two officers, Eiffel and Faber. As they tried to march him off the train, calling Friedrich a lunatic and promising to lock him away, the whistle blew, long and insistent. The train lurched forward and began to move. Eiffel and Faber shoved him aside, scrambled to the door, and leaped to the platform as the train tick-tick-ticked over the rails, leaving them far behind. Uncle Gunther had been right about the holidays. More people were traveling. The trains were crowded. Everyone held packages and seemed more preoccupied with the season than with a self-conscious boy gripping his father's future on his way to Dachau. After the commandant listened to Friedrich's appeal and examined the box of cookies, he accepted the package and sent for father. Friedrich tried not to look alarmed when he saw him. In a little over a month, father had gone from energetic and strong to weak and frail. He dragged one leg. He seemed disoriented. Friedrich helped him from the camp, walking and resting every few minutes until they reached the first farm, where Friedrich borrowed a goat cart and pulled father to Munich, to the home of Uncle Gunther's friend, the doctor. It took weeks for father to recuperate enough to begin their journey to Switzerland. Father refused to talk about what had happened to him at the camp, insisting that it was nothing compared to what was done to others, and becoming tearful and adamant that he was one of the fortunate. After a while, Friedrich stopped asking. Uncle Gunther was waiting for them in Bern. He and Friedrich took jobs in a Swiss chocolate factory. Father gave cello lessons. Eventually, Friedrich applied to the Bern Conservatory. One path led to another. It was strange how, on such an auspicious occasion as tonight, in one of the most famous venues in the world, Friedrich's thoughts kept wandering back to his beginnings. He looked down at his father and uncle, who by some miracle were at his side, safe and healthy. And instead of the concert before him, Friedrich flashed back to his happiest childhood memories of Friday night get-togethers in the parlor with Elizabeth at the piano, Uncle Gunther on his accordion, father on cello, and Friedrich on harmonica, their polkas accompanied by the occasional rally from the cuckoo clock in the hall. Musicians began to appear on the grand stage. Dressed in black, they took their chairs, adjusted their music stands, and opened the scores. The wind instruments ran the scale to warm the pipes. The violins mewled and purred. Friedrich stood. I should go. He smiled at father and Uncle Gunther and headed toward the side stage door. Before he opened it, he glanced back at the house. Father and Uncle Gunther looked small amid the field of red velvet seats. Father sat straight and tall, studying his program. Friedrich could feel his pride, even from a distance. The ushers opened the lobby doors and people began to filter inside. Friedrich fled backstage, stepping up to the wing and leaning against the wall. He closed his eyes and concentrated on the concert, a portrait of stage and film. He smiled. Musicals and movies were such an American fondness, and, he admitted, he liked them too. He replayed the program in his mind, the first half dedicated to George and Ira Gershwin, starting with Porgy and Bess, a symphonic picture, orchestration by Robert Russell Bennett, with the main songs from the opera. Friedrich loved the orchestral, classical composition. It would be followed by Rhapsody in Blue with a featured piano soloist. After intermission, he would conduct the South Pacific Suite, music and lyrics by Rodgers and Hammerstein. It was the most popular musical in the city right now, and a coveted ticket on Broadway. The baritone, Robert Merrill, would perform selected songs from the musical, closing with Some Enchanted Evening. There were rumors that the composer and librettist, Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, friends of Robert Merrill, would be in the audience. Friedrich closed his eyes and his hands went through the motions of conducting the first overture. For a moment, he stopped and looked around before starting again, his memories so deeply set that he couldn't help but remember the school bench where he'd once been bullied for conducting an imaginary orchestra. But here, everyone was focused on becoming one voice. They all spoke the same language and had found their way to this night with their own stories of determination and practice and their love for music. Here, he was safe. The stage manager nodded to Friedrich. The musicians were in position. The concertmaster stood and lifted his violin, playing the A. On stage, the violins hummed in response. The cellos and basses moaned softly. Chords filled the room as the musicians checked the tuning of their instruments. The oboe sounded and the wind instruments matched it. Friedrich searched out the new flutist. She'd seemed nervous in rehearsals, so he'd taken time to talk with her. She was one of the youngest players he'd ever encountered in a symphony orchestra, but supremely talented. There was something intense and purposeful about how she played, a feeling he couldn't quite pinpoint, but, at the same time, understood. Her eagerness to embrace the music and surrender to it reminded him, somehow, of himself. Bit by bit, the sounds dwindled, the hall hushed. When the house lights dimmed, a smattering of clapping erupted. The stage manager pointed at Friedrich. Although he'd long come to terms with the birthmark on his face, and even refused the heavy stage makeup that some managers offered him, Friedrich still hesitated for a few seconds in the wing, wanting and dreading the walk on stage. Every performance in front of an audience was always a journey, fraught with the unknown. He whispered the good luck phrase he always said before he headed to the conductor's podium. The same words he'd whispered to his harmonica that day that he'd polished it and sent it out into the world. Gute Reise, safe travels. He strode on stage and was met by a wave of applause. Friedrich picked up his baton and raised his arms, poised to give a slight flick of the wrist to the percussionists. Four long chimes, like stepping stones to another world, rang out. Friedrich slipped into the opera's story, the music filling him with the emotion of Porgy's plight, much of it resonating in his own heart. A lonely man with a crippled body, a bully who thought he could rule the world, an ever-present evil, the loss of a loved one to something beyond his control, and what seemed an insurmountable challenge. Friedrich moved the orchestra into the tender song, Summertime, and anticipated the rising emotion in the music. He imagined the lyrics, "Hush, little baby, don't you cry." The music was bigger than Friedrich, overpoweringly beautiful, euphoric, and true. He was swept inside it. The orchestra was with him, and he was with them. This was what he had craved as a young boy when he imagined himself on the top rung of the A-frame ladder on the factory floor, two stories high, and directing an imaginary symphony, a magnificent sound from a union of many. A story that came alive through the playing. He brought the orchestra to a crescendo and a final emphatic finish. When the music stopped, Friedrich held his breath and waited. There was always a moment after the last sounds and before the ovation, an elegant pause that Friedrich cherished. It was a pure space filled with one question. Had the audience listened with its heart?